Hey team, you're about to experience my interview with David Wax from Handwritten. He is the founder and CEO of Handwritten, and Handwritten is an amazing online technology that takes your words and writes handwritten notes in pen and ink, all driven and powered by AI. It creates extremely realistic experiences around handwritten notes, but it brings it into the world of digital and e-commerce by being able to integrate these experiences directly into your marketing automation and marketing workflows, or retaining that authenticity of genuine pen and ink. We had a fantastic conversation, and I hope you enjoy. This is the E-Commerce Edge podcast with your host, Jason Greenwood. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Pod. It is my extreme pleasure to welcome David Wax from Handwritten to the podcast today. Welcome, David.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason. It's a real pleasure.
My pleasure. And look, I'm looking at your background here, and this looks like a recording studio. This is a pretty cool background you got going on there.
Actually, it's virtual. A photo of the front lobby. So we have a giant neon sign that says, "All hail the robots." I can explain why when we get to that part. But basically, we're just preparing for the eventual robot takeover, and we want to kiss their asses now so we're in good form.
Oh, totally. Every time I yell at the woman speaking to me through Google Nav, I always think, geez, maybe I should watch my tone, because once they take over, there's going to be some extreme levels of payback.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, no, it's not behind me, but it is, I don't know, right around the corner. Yeah.
Absolutely love it. Freaking brilliant. Look, we're going to have a great conversation today about your tech and what you do and how you do it. But before we get straight into that, tell me your kind of almost your origin story. You're in, you come from Credit Suisse, and you were an equity analyst. Then you were president and founder of Sellit, SVP of mobile, head of health, Kaizen Health, founder and CEO now of Handwritten. It feels you've obviously got this entrepreneurial streak, but you've been doing Handwritten for almost 10 years now. Right. So how does an equity analyst go into tech, then go into health, and then go into being an entrepreneur, like straight up entrepreneur, creating a tech platform? Like how does that work?
I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. And from the young age of 5, I'd go door to door selling stuff. My mom would go to the Costco and buy a bunch of stuff, and then I put it in my red wagon. I'd go door to door and try to sell it. And if I didn't have anything to sell, I'd go door to door with the first aid kit and ask if any emergencies were going on. And they'd politely say no to the 5-year-old. And then I'd say, okay, I'll try back later. I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. And then I went to college, graduated with engineering and business degrees and a lot of debt. So I couldn't be an entrepreneur right away. I had to go work for the man for a bit. So I did that. I worked for a consulting firm, and then Credit Suisse, and then very briefly, a venture capital firm in San Diego, where I was promptly fired without cause, but I was fired. So then I started Sellit pretty much the next day. And Sellit was designed, it started before the iPhone came out, and it was to provide information on real estate. So you drive by a house, this is back in 2004, you drive by a house, you'd want info on the house, but there was no Zillow, there was an empty flyer box, there was no way to get info. So you text in, you get information on your phone, because there you'd see a sign on the listing that would say, text this to that to get info. And then you'd get the info, and then the realtor would get a lead. And we turned that business from that to also providing text messaging for restaurants and bars. And then from all of that, we worked for brands like Marie Claire magazine. Same thing as real estate, just text in for info on a cosmetic in the magazine. And the restaurants and bars became Toys R Us, Abercrombie & Fitch, Sam's Club, Office Max, and big American brands. So by the end, we were doing over 1 million texts a day, and sold that company to ePrize and became their SVP of mobile, to answer your question there. And then from there, I had to work for them for 2 years, worked for 2 years, and then I realized, and this is now 2014, that there's so much electronic noise, whether it's emails, texts, and I was certainly guilty of the texts, Slack, Twitter, Facebook, whatever it was, there's tons of electronic noise. And what really stood out was old-fashioned handwritten correspondence. When you got a handwritten note, you'd save it, You'd put it on display, not only read it, but put it on display. I started handwritten to the healthcare thing. One of my ex-employees at Sellit, my last company, went on to start a healthcare tech startup. She's still running it now. She's tremendously successful. I'm very proud of her. And I was the CTO for a bit. So that was a side gig. But now I run Handwritten full time for the last 9 years, to your point. And we, I believe, are the largest provider of our service in the world. We have 175 robots that all hold pens, and they write out handwritten notes at scale. On a given day, right now it's the holidays, so we're doing 20,000 notes a day. These are Merry Christmas notes, thank you for your purchase notes, anniversary, birthday, prospecting, whatever it might be. And we help brands, small and large, stay in touch through old-fashioned handwritten notes. And so for e-com brands, this could be integrating us with your Shopify store. We have a plugin directly for Shopify. It could be just logging into our website, uploading your client list and sending out notes. Whatever it is, we try to figure out a way to help our brands. And we do this for individuals all the way up to major department stores.
Wow. That is quite the journey. You have been hard at work, my friend, and it sounds like the exit was almost the springboard to being able to do almost whatever you want. And you obviously chose this, and you were like, how can I bring
you? Work choice.
Yeah. You obviously, when you get to a place in life where maybe you've secured enough of the bag that you're not living hand to mouth anymore or going, God, what if I lose my job? How many weeks of rent can I pay or mortgage can I pay before I need to actually go get another job again? So you've set yourself up to where now you have the freedom to be able to exercise your entrepreneurial passion. And you've now been able to do that for nearly a decade. So that's super cool. It's super cool that you know, that founder's journey. It's always interesting how people end up in this digital/e-commerce related space. Everybody's got their own journey. But what I have found is that more often than not, people have fallen into this industry as opposed to necessarily had a direct plan and path to getting into this industry. I know for myself, I fell into this industry over 20 years ago. Like, I had a friend who their friend owned an agency, and I was between what I was doing at the time, and I was like, I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to do next. And he happened to be another American guy that was living in New Zealand, same as me at the time. And so our mutual friend introduced us, and he said, look, I'm building this agency, and we're looking for good people that are pretty tech savvy, and we're doing all this. And I was like, oh, this sounds like a good thing. I know this internet thing's got legs, so why don't I plunge right into the deep end? And it was the best career choice I could have ever made, because here I am 23 years later doing the same things. It's interesting. The founder's journey is such an interesting thing, isn't it?
Yeah. When I got fired from that VC firm 20 years ago, 20 some odd years ago, at the time it was the worst thing that happened to me. But in recollect, it's by far the best, because it was the swift kick in the butt I needed to begin my entrepreneurial journey. And it has not been easy, as I'm sure you can attest. But it's been very rewarding, if not financially, just seeing the progression of my employees and providing jobs. Now I've got 50 people, give or take, that rely on the company. And that's very, so.
It is. The fact that you're able to help people better life, that's pretty impressive. It puts the pressure on you to keep bringing the bacon home, to keep everybody fed. But it's super rewarding, as you say. And how have you guys navigated nowadays? I think there's probably something major robot written notes companies that this space has absolutely exploded. I think, and I'd love your take on this, it's exploded primarily because when you digitize that service, now it's much easier to integrate into a MarTech, ad tech type workflow where it becomes, for example, just another node in a Klaviyo workflow or in a MarTech workflow. You now have been able to harmonize it in with other channels in such a way that now we can have this full-scale omni-channel marketing effort across multiple channels, but in a harmonized way. So instead, back in the old days, because I remember the days when direct mail was still a thing as part of an omni-channel play, but this was all managed by, say, for example, an e-com manager or a marketing manager, and they had to keep straight what was going to which person based on email addresses. And it was really hard. It was really hard not to just kill an individual customer with so many marketing channels and so many messages hitting them at the same time. Now, with modern MarTech stacks, we don't do that. We have automatic suppression of certain people from a list that don't respond to certain channel types or certain message types or certain campaigns. So we have a lot more control over the type of experience a customer has across all our marketing channels. And it feels to me like that was the catalyst for allowing a service like yours to go absolutely mainstream.
Yes, we always designed Handwritten to be, when I started, there was us and then quickly one other company called Bond that has since gone out of business. And now you're right. And there's, I don't know if there's 20 or 30, but there's certainly a solid handful in the States and then a couple more internationally. But we were always designed to be a platform, not a website. So what I mean by this is pretty much everything you can do on the website, you can do via API. And we've exposed those API endpoints to Shopify, to Zapier, to Make.com, to Salesforce, to HubSpot, to automotive dealership platforms, to nonprofit platforms. So we have a very wide surface of where we integrate across all these platforms. And I think that's set us apart in addition. So it's scale and scope. The scale being the robots that we're building all the time, the scope being the surface of where you can find Handwritten. And then I guess on top of that, the software, if you say the three S's, and the software being able to do delivery tracking and prospecting and everything else. But it was always designed with the idea of sending a handwritten note should be easier than sending an email. And I think we've accomplished that now just by all the integrations. But yeah, and to your point, integrating with Zapier. Zapier was the big one. I had never heard of Zapier. It was brought to my attention by a client and we integrated and it really changed our business. So much so that Zapier, on YouTube, you might see videos of us pop up in ads for Zapier now. So yeah, it's really about designing yourself as a platform, not as a website.
No question about it. And it feels like you guys, I could be completely wrong here, but it feels like you guys don't necessarily cater to the one-off person like me sending one note to my mother, although I'm sure you could support that. Yeah. You're probably more geared towards almost industrial scale automated sending that someone needs to send. They're a business. It's usually business to business. Your service isn't really targeted at the B2C consumer of your service.
It's been both and it's a struggle. But for instance, we did Black Friday. Black Friday was very consumer focused, 25% off prices today. Cyber Monday was business focused, get subscriptions. So you can go on our website and send a single card because in the end, every B2B client is a consumer. So by introducing them to the Handwritten brand by sending their mom a card or whatever, at least gets them going. And then hopefully the idea is they then place a 10,000 card order. Whether they do it or not is another thing. But a lot of the work we've done, in particular in the last 6 months, has been about operational efficiency. And in addition to having nearly 200 robots that we build, design and build in our facility, we also have dual printing presses. And then we have industrial stuffing machines and artificial intelligent computer vision systems. So that the idea is, and we're 90% of the way there, is to create operational efficiency. So it's not harder for us to handle what, because it used to be much more costly for us to handle a single order than a bulk order. But we're trying to get to the point where there's no difference. You can load 10,000 or whatever, 100 different cards into a robot, each one being completely different. And they'd all go through, they'd get the right robot message written in the right handwriting style, get the right inserts and get mailed. We've been really focused for the past 6 or 8 months on operational efficiency to make that happen. But to your point, obviously we love the big orders. The cost to acquire a client with Google ads is so great that we can't even do Google.
Yeah.
Because the cost to acquire a client's $5 or $8 or $12 and the net margin on a sale is like a dollar.
It just doesn't make sense. And as you say, the competition is now higher, so therefore it's pushing up those costs and costs through Meta and Google. There's lots of companies that just can't advertise through those platforms anymore. And so they're having to do more guerrilla-style marketing, partnership-style marketing, et cetera. And I'm one of the things that you said caught my ear, which was we design and build our own robots. Yep. And I'm thinking to myself, there must be some kind of value add for doing that because obviously there are tons of off-the-shelf robots that can be adapted to do different things. It feels like something could be adapted, but maybe not 10 years ago. And so you were stuck between a rock and a hard place. Geez, if we don't develop our own technology, we're going to be we're going to be so screwed here? Or was it like, actually, this is something that by keeping it proprietary, it becomes part of our secret sauce, part of our recipe, part of something that we can control, that we don't have to rely on the help of others for a core part of our functionality?
Yeah. So when we started the company in 2014, we used off-the-shelf auto pens, which are antiquated handwriting machines. And those are fine if you're doing 50 orders a day or 500 orders a day, but you get beyond that and they're not fine because they're not autonomous. You got to plug them into a computer. At most, maybe you could plug 10 into a computer. We have our autonomous robot that we can send orders to over a network. We can update the robots themselves over the network. And the writing is more of a software issue than a hardware issue. You can get anything to write if you're a good coder. There's Axie Draws and different things. It's an XY plane that you can do it with a CNC machine. That's not the hard part. The software to get it right, writing realistically and subtly, is where a lot of our effort has gone. Additionally, believe it or not, in the paper handling. You can buy one of these off-the-shelf robot arms, but then how do you get the paper through it? And how do you keep it running 24 hours a day because they're slow? A lot of our work has been in paper handling and then the software of the writing to make it look more and more realistic. And because we build them in our in-house, we don't outsource that to another company, our cost to scale is substantially less than anybody else. What I mean by that is it's a linear function. The more orders you have, the more robots you need, right? But if we have to go out and pay $8,000 or $12,000 a robot, that's a lot. If we're able to do that for a fraction of the price because we build them in-house and we're able to build them quicker, it's a real competitive advantage. And then additionally, just the flexibility, our robots can add your own signature. We can, like I said about the computer vision and order management through the system, those are all done in-house, and we're able to do that because we have all the IP in-house. So it's a complicated project. I've got 4 dedicated robot machinists. I've got software programmers. I've got graphic designers. It's just a very, and then all the API integrations. It's a complicated project.
And it's never ending because as you say, as you scale, you need to keep adding more capacity. Plus, obviously, ideally, you'd like to enhance and optimize along the way as well. So the existing installations need to be enhanced and upgraded and everything else. So it feels like it's not one of those one and done scenarios. It's a never ending part of the business.
We're tearing down robots all the time. Yeah, we're doing that. And then we're just trying to look at our business very differently now than we did 6 months ago. Just how do you get an order from the back end to a robot, to the stuffing machine, et cetera. It's systems engineering problem, basically.
And it feels like that would also add a significant amount of enterprise value to the business for any potential acquirer. Obviously, I have no idea whether you have any intention to sell at any point in time, but if you did, then presumably owning all of that IP in-house enhances the enterprise value of the business because you're not at the mercy of the third-party market as a result.
We have Canon digital presses and this enormous German stuffing machine. Those are external, but how do we get the orders to the digital press? And how do we match up the card to the envelope on the stuffing machine? Those are proprietary IP and it's crazy tech. So yeah, there's a lot of tech here.
Wow. But what the end result is an extremely personalized, but so it's automated for the merchant, but it's personalized for the recipient. And I think that's where the technology bridges the gap. And so I'm guessing that you maybe, I don't know, do you program in things like intentional artifacts or intentional slight changes? Instead of just having a normal font kit or whatever that you use, you design in intentional imperfections, which is what a normal person. So you've got to almost introduce intentional variability in things to keep them looking authentic and feeling natural.
Yeah. So we vary the left margin. So it's not like somebody wrote down a hard edge of a page. We vary the interline spacing. So it doesn't look like you wrote on ruled paper. We warp the text ever so slightly. So it looks like you're trying to write straight, but you didn't do that great of a job. And then we vary every character so that each character looks different from the next. And where those characters are in the word helps change that up. We deal with ligature combinations. So Do you cross two T's with one crossbar two? How do you connect your O's? How do two cursive L's look together? How does an O look at the end of a word versus the beginning? All these types of nuances are taken into account. And then how do you draw emojis? If somebody does a smiley, how's that supposed to look? If they do a colon, how do you translate the colon parenthesis into a smiley face, or less than three into a heart? So we take all of this into account, and it's a complicated process, to say the least. But yeah, all of that, we're the longest running player out there. So we've had to take all this into account over time.
Man, what an absolute mission to get it to where you want it to be and continually improve upon it. And it feels like, if you've been doing it for almost a decade, it feels you'd almost run out of things to improve. But I guess then you enhance and extend the service and add new functionality and options. And
yeah. So for instance, for your listeners, the Shopify integration, right now we're adding abandoned cart notifications. So imagine somebody goes to your sunglass website, they don't buy a pair of sunglasses. 4 days later or 6 days later, they get a handwritten note from you saying, we wish you'd come back and look at your cart. We already do thank you notes through Shopify and some other things, but there's always new things to add to the platform. Yeah, our dev roadmap is never, always something going on.
And how do you think about it through the lens of partnerships? Meaning, oftentimes these types of services, they'll have to be integrated. It's great that you got Zapier. It's great that you got Make. It's great that you got Shopify. But in my experience, most of the time, these services need to be in directly integrated into the MarTech or AdTech stack. They've got to be integrated directly into marketing automation and CDP platforms. They've got to be directly integrated. And usually those are custom level integrations, which usually means the agency that the e-commerce vendor or the e-commerce merchant is working with does have to do some level of heavy lifting through APIs, et cetera. And it feels like a natural segue for you guys to get embedded in that market would be to work with agency partners who can recommend your platform, build their sort of library of integrations in-house they can redeploy over and over again. And it feels like that would be a great vector for you to get good penetration into the e-commerce market. What does your go-to-market look like for e-commerce merchants to put yourselves on their radar? So that because a lot of merchants, despite the fact that this has been an option for quite a long time now, and you guys have clearly been around for a heck of a long time, it's still not necessarily a default go-to for merchants in the ecosystem. And so you've got to create awareness before a merchant can even consider you.
Yeah, most people don't know this is an option. So we do have a couple CDP partners. We've certainly got a full API stack, and we've got integration engineers on staff to help with those integrations. We spend a lot on PR, just trying to boil the ocean of demand and attending trade shows and speaking at trade shows. Podcasts, I try to do a few podcasts every month. So we are trying to find those types of partnerships to really drive integration. We're getting a little bit better at it, but for most part, and we're parts of referral affiliate networks now, but it's a challenge, quite frankly. It's a challenge. We're just doing everything we can to try to grow our footprint, but we are a small self-funded company. So our growth trajectory is this, not like that, because we're growing profitably.
Wow. For amazing.
It's a diagonal line, say, not a vertical line.
I got it. And obviously that would have put you in good stead when the funding taps got turned off in 2021, late 2021, and everybody else was freaking out, especially those that were VC funded, and the world looked like it was going to come to an end. And hey, even now, as we go into an intentional recession to try to cool the global economy off, that whole word that was dirty prior to 2021, that word profit, now all of a sudden it's come back into vogue again, and investors really want to invest in profitable companies, or at least companies that are within cooey of profitability and have a quick path to get there. Otherwise, they don't really want to touch it. It's like kryptonite to VCs now, unprofitable companies. And they had to write down significant investments over the last couple of years that weren't profitable, and they couldn't just keep pouring good money after bad. So it feels like that approach for you guys has allowed you to build a very sustainable business.
Yeah, the issue is because our growth rate is limited due to remaining profitable, nobody's interested. It's still the fact that if we weren't profitable, they wouldn't be able to measure us on EBITDA, and therefore they provide us a ridiculous rev multiple. That said, one of our competitors in the real estate space went under last week, and they raised $20 million in funding. Handwritten's raised $0. And here we are, and they just went under because they couldn't raise a second round, and their pants were, they were caught with their pants down. They were waiting on that second round. The investor backed out at the 11th hour. It's just amazing to me how you'd think investors would want to invest in smartly run companies, but they don't. And then trying to take a company that's been given $20 million and say, okay, now you have to have some financial rigor associated with that. Here's another $20 million, but I want you to spend it wisely, unlike the first $20 million. Good luck. Yeah. Now you have a whole staff of people that are paid huge salaries. What are you supposed to do about that? And your marketing budget, you're depending on marketing budgets that are through the roof, and you've undercut everybody else's pricing. Now you got to triple your pricing, so it's there's some margin in there. What are you going to do? But that's, so it's, we're not, I've given up trying to raise money because it's a huge waste of time. I get these calls from VCs. Oh, we're interested in learning about you. And I say, X, Y, and Z, this is how we are. We're not growing at 50% a year, but we're profitable and we've got IP and patents and everything. Oh, I still think it's worthless speaking. So then I waste an hour on the phone with these guys and they say, your growth rate's not high enough. I said, no, I told you that on the phone, or I told you that by email. So why are you wasting my time, Dodo? My time's highly valuable and it's not worth being on the phone with these, I'll reserve my language for it, but that's what it is.
And you're in Phoenix, right? And I understand that the Phoenix Open, I've heard through the grapevine that the Phoenix Open is just a huge event and lots of investors like to come along. And it's a bit of an, I don't want to call it like Silicon Valley-esque, but from what I hear, this is turning into a little micro hotbed of investment discussions, and it's opening up doors. And as I understand it, particularly surrounding those big events like the Phoenix Open, it's like drawing a lot of investors and tech like moths to a flame. It's becoming a little almost hidden hotspot of innovation.
Yeah, you have to look for it, but it's here. I would not be able to run my business in California. The cost of labor, the cost of firing people that are
compliance
not-
costs, regulations.
Yeah, taxes. I just wouldn't be able to run the business. So I'm fortunate that I can run this low margin business here in Phoenix, because it just wouldn't be able to run at all. And that's where Addressable, the company that went out of business, was based. Yeah, I'm fortunate from that. And there is talent here. ASU, Arizona State University, is right around the corner. So we're able to recruit interns, mechanical engineers, and stuff like that. So it's been a good place. And it's also a very pro-business environments. We've had the press out here a number of times and members of the government and local government and stuff like that. So it is a good, I'd say it's a good place to try to start a business. That said, it's also getting very expensive like everywhere else.
Yeah.
During COVID, everybody learned they could work remote. So why not take that high paying salary and move to Mexico like you did, or move to Arizona and buy a house and drive up our real estate prices. So that's what's happened here too.
Wow. Yeah, that's definitely happening all around the world now. I've seen the people flows as I've traveled around. It's pretty insane. But I guess the trade-off is we all get an extreme amount of flexibility and freedom in our lives, which is definitely worthwhile, I would say, if you can get it. But when it comes to e-commerce merchants, do you think that as email is so overdone, it's just been done to death and people have inbox I'd love to know what the unsubscribe rates are like during massive, you know, sales seasons like BFCM and things like that. I bet the unsubscribe rates go through the roof. I bet SMS unsubscribe rates go through the roof. I bet basically any of the traditional marketing methods must just get absolutely hammered and people just cry uncle and they just say, no, I'm opting out of the whole bloody lot because I just feel so overwhelmed. But it feels like direct mail, and I can only speak from my own personal experience. So when I was still back in New Zealand, there was a company that I bought with online. They were an online wine company. I can't remember how I first found out about them, but then I bought some wine. I actually think it might have even been a physical mailing even first. But anyways, I bought through these guys. And then from then on, obviously I could go to their website. I was in their database. They would send me occasional emails, but they continued, even once I was in their email database, they continued to send me regular postal mail. And it was actually, because I grew up in an era where direct mail was the norm. There wasn't, when I first started growing up, that was before the internet was a thing. And there was no such thing as email. Then there was no such thing as SMS. And all these things came along laterally. But it was actually somewhat refreshing. I know that when I was younger, junk mail, as we like to call it, would go straight in the bin. Like it wouldn't even get opened. It would just, there was a pile of regular mail that we wanted to open. There was a pile of junk mail. The junk mail went straight over the side of the counter into the rubbish bin, and the family mail or the business email, business physical mail would get opened. And that's how we lived our lives. We'd open maybe 1 in 100 pieces of quote unquote junk mail if it was maybe from a local supermarket. They were running a special on something we wanted to buy. But it feels like now, at least speaking for myself, when I receive physical mail from an e-commerce merchant or a primarily e-commerce merchant, it's actually novel. It actually prompts me, especially depending on what's printed on the front of the envelope or whatever it is, really engaging. I want to open that because it's got a sense of novelness. I don't know if that's a word, but anyways, it's just novel. It feels novel. It feels like it gets cut through, at least with me. It gets cut through like it never did before. And I feel like that's prompting maybe a bit of the resurgence of actual physical direct mail.
Yeah, back maybe 3-4 years ago, there was a stat that, and things have certainly gotten much worse since then, that the average office worker gets about 134 emails a day. They spend 24% of their time just managing their inbox. Now it's way worse because now you have Sales Loft and Persist IQ and Reply.io, all these platforms that just keep emailing you until you reply back. So it's not enough to delete it. You have to actually reply. So now I have a hotkey on my keyboard that basically says, stop your shameful spamming ways, and it does it for me. But with that, and then you add in everything else, the text, everything else, which is easy. But receiving the least used inbox these days is the one at the end of the driveway. Nobody's sending notes and nobody's sending handwritten notes. The average person only gets one to three handwritten notes a month compared to 134 emails a day. The impact there is big. We see our client, and then if it's handwritten, the envelope itself gets a 3 times greater open rate than a printed envelope. We see response rates 27 times greater than print mail. We see ROIs 500% for some of our clients. I was just on the phone yesterday with an automotive dealer who said, yeah, we see a 500% ROI when we use you guys because it resonates with people and you have to know how to use it. It's not don't use email, don't use text, don't use Facebook. It's use this too and know when to use it and how to appropriately use it. And that's what we try to guide our clients to do, is use it appropriately to get those types of results. And they're able to drive customer lifetime value. They're able to improve repurchase rates. They're able to increase their virality of, basically grow their social media presence. They're able to basically everything, improve their political campaigns, whatever it might be, improve redonation rates if they're a nonprofit, everything by leveraging what's considered old school. What's old, when everybody pivots right digital, and you pivot left analog, you really are able to stand out and get open versus just be deleted as quickly as possible, like I do with my email. I don't even read it. If I see someone that says, just bring in this to the top of your inbox, they hit my hotkey and they get deleted.
Yeah, I understand. And it feels like this is also part of a greater, wider trend, which is that, as you say, what's old is new again, but digitalizing the way in which we control that old media type. For example, it used to be that only the largest companies, most successful companies in the world could use billboards because they were so bloody expensive, right? And also billboards fell out of favor because people in cars that weren't the driver were on their phone, and so they'd never see the billboard anyway. And so they fell out of favor. But as digital billboards became the norm instead of just plain old physical billboards, where you could programmatically load your creative into an ad platform that then could to place that up. You could place it up for a day, a week, a month, and you could place it in different placements. And you could control all that granularly yep. through a digital interface. It made not only booking that easier, it made it easier for the billboard owner to manage the placements and get them uploaded because now you didn't actually have to make a physical fronting for that. And so, and also the cost of billboards, because digital took over, the cost of billboard placements fell through the floor. So now all of a sudden, I wouldn't say if you're a small business, you could do a billboard, but I would say if you're an MB, a medium business or bigger, now billboards, especially regional billboards that are maybe in fringe areas, now all of a sudden, these are starting to become affordable for many more businesses nowadays. And so sure, maybe they don't get the visibility that they used to, but the visibility that they do get is probably going to lead to much better engagement rates. So therefore, if the price of that media is reasonable, all of a sudden now maybe it becomes viable again. And so there's lots of these sort of traditional media types that have been digitized to bring them into a digital media workflow that is better for everybody. It brings efficiency and automation for everyone, and that's what brings the cost down.
Percent, yeah. And you're able to do things like time parted that you want a digital billboard that you couldn't do before. Just show ads around dinner time or whatever. And yeah, we're sending one handwritten note as a person is doable. But if you're trying to send thank you notes to all your customers and you have 10,000 customers, it's just not going to get done no matter how, what your intentions are. So you have two options. You could have a bunch of interns do it, and their handwriting will stink and they can screw up and they can get grease on them if you're having a pizza party to get them all to do it. And the risk is high and the compliance or the consistency of brand is way low. Or you can use robots to do it and then your consistency is high, your risk is low, and your compliance is perfect. So that's where we step in. We help brands, luxury to auto dealers to everything else, stay consistent and stay in front of their clients in ways that are underserved.
And how, if we had to look at the percentage or the breakdown of the segments that you service, what percentage of Total Mail roughly would be going out on behalf of an e-commerce merchant versus some other type of business that's not necessarily e-commerce?
Yeah, right now, because it's the holidays, we're handling a lot of mail right now from tens of thousands of customers, but we have a couple really big e-commerce brands that outsize the rest. So I'd say probably 20% of our order volume, but that comes from 5% of our clients.
Wow.
The other ones are agents by the bushel basket. We have a lot of real estate agents using us, their mortgage and professional services, insurance brokers, that type of thing. And then car dealerships, nonprofits. Yeah. And then retail type brands using us.
And in terms of, I guess, the visibility within the e-commerce space, because it sounds like they would have an outsized positive impact on the business if you could secure more of those types of merchants. Yeah. Is it worthwhile for you guys to maybe think about attending e-commerce specific conferences or e-commerce specific events where you could speak at those events and maybe get a discounted fee where it wouldn't necessarily cost you anything if you were contributing to the content of the conference instead of going maybe to an...
Funny conferences, hook us up, man. We were attending several. I've got a lot of competitors that I know for a fact listen to us, so I don't want to share everything. But yeah, we're 20 is a big year of conferences. Not so much speaking per se, but attending trade shows and that type of thing, exhibiting. So you can expect to see us at the standard trade show conferences next year. And then getting into very niche conferences for different verticals as well, you know, whether it's beauty or whatever else. We're not spending any money on Google right now because of the cost per acquisition. And we've moved that money to trade shows. So you nailed it.
Wow. Amazing. And then obviously there's, of course, conferences for real estate agents. And so for all these major segments, there's conferences for just about every vertical, right?
Yeah. And it's real estate is an interesting thing because it's really a B2C play. You have to deal with realtors as if they're consumers. So it's we don't really go after real estate. It's too expensive. But if it falls in our lap, we'll take it. We'll be the best client, a vendor for them. But yes, we've attended a few brokerage trade shows. It could be like a Century 21 trade show or something like that, but not NAR. I've been through that right now. My past life with Sell It, I was at all those trade shows, and it's very hard to make traction at those.
And what about the legal industry? I would have thought the legal industry would be also a one that would want to automate some personal mail.
Yeah, we work with a couple lawyers that you might have heard of, these national chains. We also work with a couple lawyer client management systems so that from within those you can send handwritten notes. Yeah. People say, what type of industries you work with? I say anybody that can benefit with a handwritten note. And so it's a lot. And we're thinly represented in a lot of these verticals, basically.
Yeah, I would have thought also medical and dental and all, like anything where the personal touch really matters and it really makes a difference. It feels like those verticals in particular are the ones that just are perfect for your services.
Yeah. If you go to our website and you go to the resources tab, you can download the consumer outreach survey for free. It's a PDF, it's 5 or 6 page PDF. We did a survey of 2,000 consumers And we asked them, do you feel appreciated by your car dealer, dentist, realtor, whatever? And by and large, the answer is no. And we said, and then we asked them, what's a personal form of communication? The number one personal form of communication is actually phone calls, not handwritten notes. Number two was handwritten notes. We asked them, what's the most annoying form of communication? The most annoying form of communication is phone calls. The least annoying is handwritten notes. So we're really trying to help clients of all verticals leverage handwritten notes to run to walk the line of being non-annoying and highly personal, as the benefits from that are dramatic. So yeah, I mean, and that's why we integrate with Black Bond, which is a nonprofit donor management system, and CDK, which is a dealer management system for auto, and Shopify. And we're trying to be there for everybody, because in the end, the product is the same, but the service is very different. So there's a lot of ground to cover, and we are working with channel partners to make that a reality in a number of these cases.
Amazing. And if you were to look out over the next 12, 18 months, you already said you've got a dev list as long as your arm, but is there anything that your customers are asking for today that they say, oh, we'd love it if you did this too, that you don't currently do that you're going to do? Or is there something you personally have said, hey, look, we don't do this today, but we see it as either important or emerging, and we're definitely going to focus on this over the next 12 to 18 months as an enhancement to our current service offering?
Yeah. So last week, we rolled out multi-step campaigns where you can enroll somebody on their own time frame to receive handwritten notes over time. So maybe today, excuse me, I'd enroll you to receive a handwritten note today, followed by one in a month, followed by one 3 months later, et cetera. And then in a month, I do another podcast with somebody else and they get their first note today, and then one. So everybody's on their own time frame. So we do that. That's as of last week. The one thing that we don't currently have integrated are QR codes that are unique. And we are looking to add them. There's some serious operational issues that go around with that, but people want everything to be trackable, and not everybody will get your mail, and then not everybody's going to scan a QR code. So it's one of these things that, yeah, we're going to do it when we can, but I don't want people to think just because they didn't scan the QR code, they didn't open the mail and respond to it. So there's a lot of that type of stuff going on. So I'd say the big thing for 24 is QR codes. Maybe some additional changes or customization on placement of wording and being able to say, I want to draw a big heart in the upper right and a smiley face in the lower left and right and a diagonal, all that type of stuff we might add in 24. But for the most part, I think our product is pretty well baked, and we're just trying to integrate with more and more platforms at this point.
Makes total sense. And how does your pricing work? It's a per item, you know, fee. It looks like pricing starts at $325. Most are available for $375 plus postage. And I guess it just really depends on the volume, but you're also in some respects like quite a traditional SaaS business, even though you're not strictly just a purely digital business. It's very much a physical business, but you do have that tiered model for someone that's maybe a commercial partner. They're going to do things at scale, silver, gold, platinum, more plans available. And they include a certain number of cards per month. And you make it very clear how much discount they get as a result of that and what the total price to them is going to be per month. So you've got the ad hoc engagement model plus the tiered SaaS type model as well. You offer both.
Yep, correct. Yeah, we have prepaid plans and subscriptions and one-off invoiced plans, where invoice is actually our favorite, but being able to get clients used to it where they don't have to rethink about, okay, how many am I prepaying for again? That's been a kind of a, we've been navigating that recently too. But yeah, pricing's $375. The more you buy, the less it goes. We have clients paying sub $2, around $1.50, just depending on volume. It's just the more you buy, the cheaper it is, because then we were able to dedicate robots to you. We don't have to carry one single card across the warehouse to put it in robots. It's just an efficiency thing. And we want it to be affordable for everybody. I think the ROI, one of the big issues is people compare us to print. And it's just, print is a different thing. We have off the bat, 3 times the open rate and 27 times the response rates. Yeah, we're more expensive because the very first thing we do is print. And when we print a beautiful greeting card on thick cardstock, so even that's more expensive. And then at the end, we got to match envelope to card. It's not tabbed, folded mail or windowed envelope. So there's all these things that go into it that just add cost. And you can't really say it's as cheap as other things. It just generates greater results. If you're a brand, then you're looking at doing laser printed or a handwritten note. I think you should also say, okay, what's representative of the brand? Am I a everything for the cheapest? Do I have some cheap, crappy website that I built by some intern? Or do I do it right and create a good experience for the client? And if you're in the latter category, consider a company like Handwritten that can really do top of class. Be proud that we're not the cheapest. If we're the cheapest, your notes, like that company that went out of business, they were super cheap, but they took forever to get your notes out. We have people here dedicated, and because of that, it costs money so that we can get your notes out quickly and correctly and double checked and everything else. Not everything's a race to the bottom. If it was, we're the wrong customer or wrong vendor for you.
Totally. And do you guys also offer, in addition to proper folded heavy cardstock post, do you also offer things like postcards and other media types to where you can roll with that? And maybe that's even a little bit less operationally intensive, obviously, with a postcard versus a folded enveloped letter?
Yeah, we might come out with postcards. It doesn't go with our brand. We're trying to do something elevated and a postcard gets all banged up and looks cheap by the time it gets to you. We might do that in 24. We're debating it. We do trifold pieces and book plates and all other sorts of things that are handwritten. But we consider opening an envelope an unboxing experience. So there's inserts in there, whether it's a gift card to your favorite store or it's a business card or something like that. A lot of people ask for postcards, but they're asking because they're cheap. And we're not trying to do the cheapest thing out there. We're trying to elevate as opposed to, again, there are companies out there doing that.
Makes complete sense. And how do you like people to get a hold of you if they want to learn more?
Please visit handwritten.com. It's HANDWRYTEN.com. Click the business tab and request samples. See for yourself if you like it. It's free to get samples. You can find me. I'm David B as in boy, WACHS on Twitter. Look me up on LinkedIn. All our socials are at the bottom of the Handwritten website. We have a YouTube channel where we're constantly putting up webinars and how-tos and everything else. That's on the bottom of our Handwritten website too. So if you want us, you can find us. I guarantee that. And if you call us, we answer the phone. So please don't be afraid to pick up the phone and give us a call.
Love it. And on your YouTube site, do you do behind the scenes stuff, showing the Robox, to me as a tech guy, like I'd probably come to your YouTube channel just for that.
Yeah. We don't have a lot of videos showing how we build the robots.
No, but just in operation.
Oh yeah. You can see all that. Yeah, for sure.
Wow. Absolutely amazing. Now we're coming to the end of our time together and I super appreciate your time, David. We're now at the point where I get to turn the microphone over to you, let you ask me one question, any question you like, can be personal or professional. So David Wax from Handwritten, what's your question for me today?
My question would be, what trends are you busy talking with clients every week, three times a week on your podcast? What are the big trends that you're predicting for 2024?
B2B. Look, I have a massive focus on B2B e-commerce in particular. That's what my specialization is from a consultancy perspective. And B2B e-commerce is probably a decade behind, roughly 5 to 10 years behind where B2C and D2C is today. But the trajectory is just massively up and to the right. And the projected growth rate of B2B e-commerce over the next decade is around, by most studies, is around 6 to 7 times what B2C and D2C growth rates are going to look like in terms of penetration, total revenue dollars driven through those channels. I was probably a slightly early to that trend, but it feels like the market's actually coming to me now. And that feels like a really good thing. It's put me in a little bit of a pole position to be able to work with these brands that are maybe a little bit more legacy. They operate in verticals that are a little bit more legacy and haven't ever had to do e-commerce before. And there's been no demand for e-commerce. And now the next generation of both suppliers and buyers on the other end are all digital and they're younger. They're a younger demographic. They just expect everything to be able to be done digitally. And that is the trend that is just absolutely exploding. And from a technical perspective, there are more platforms targeted at B2B e-commerce, like specialist platforms targeted at B2B e-commerce now than ever before. And so being able to implement B2B e-commerce is now easier and less expensive than it used to be. So it's all coming together now, especially after COVID. A lot of these legacy B2B businesses that couldn't have their field sales reps go out and see customers because they weren't considered essential, they realized, oh my God, we don't actually have a route to get to our customers because we're not digitally enabled. We don't do EDI. We don't do punch out. We don't do e-commerce. We don't do any of that stuff. And so it really shone a light on how unprepared a lot of these businesses were to be able to go to market through digital channels. And that put the fear of God into them. It truly did. And it became a case of trying to drink out of a fire hose during COVID in terms of demand for services like mine and everything else. It just lit a massive fuse under absolutely everybody, knowing that, oh my God, a situation like this could happen again. And if we don't get prepared, we're going to be slammed again, just like we did last time. That sentiment out there of, man, everybody has to have digital routes to market, absolutely everybody, that's definitely an aspect of the market. I've never seen anything quite like it in the 23 years I've been doing this.
Interesting. It was really nice meeting you, Jason. Thank you so much for all the great questions.
Are you a B2B or D2C e-commerce merchant? Then head over to greenwoodconsulting.net to learn how we can help you scale your business.